Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting, and my website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Bill Burke-White, our foreign correspondent. We're also going to be hearing a commentary from Ron Bloomberg. Right now, I would like to welcome Robert Ripps. He is president of the board of the Desert Corral, whose season starts this coming Friday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here, too. And we've had the Desert Corral on before, at least people from it, not the entire corral. The corral is a group of professional singers who've been trained at a very high level.
Absolutely. They all are professional musicians, and they're all right in their own right, and most of them actually don't come from the Santa Fe area. They come to us in the summer and then again in the winter for our winter holiday season from as far away as Maine and Florida and California and Washington. And of the 24 that are coming this summer, I think I counted that 18 are from out of state, and six of them are local.
And what kind of repertoire do you do?
Well, that's a very good question. Because we do a very broad repertoire. Just this season, I noticed that our repertoire spans 900 centuries. There's one concert at the...
Nine hundred years.
Yeah,
we go back to the chimpanzee corals.
Yeah, even we haven't mastered that quite yet. But we have on our women's program, titled There Is Sweet Music at the Loreto Chapel, a program that encompasses Hildegard of Bingen, who is a 12th century poet and composer, mystic, and then a brand new work by a contemporary woman composer who lives in Arizona named Judith Cloud. And we run the gamut in between. But I will say that the majority of our music this season is music of the 20th and 21st century.
And we are going to play on the air now in just a few minutes some American music in honor of the 4th of July. I take it the Desert Corral, you sing in various languages and from many countries. You just mentioned Germany.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We'll be singing in Russian at the end of the season when we do the complete Rachmaninoff Vespers for the first time in Santa Fe. The Corral has performed the Vespers. This is really the pinnacle of Russian Orthodox music. It's an hour-long 15 settings of Russian liturgical texts. It's incredible music, probably some of the most beautiful that Rachmaninoff wrote, and really one of the high points of choral music. And we'll be doing that for our final two concerts on August 10th and 11th at the Cathedral. And that will really be a great moment for us. This is our 25th anniversary, and there will be alumni singers coming back. We will swell the ranks of the chorale to 34 singers to perform the Vespers.
Because you need 10 extra basses to do the Russian.
Absolutely. You need a lot of basses and some good high sopranos as well. But we have them, but it's an opportunity to increase our forces and really let that music swell in the incredible acoustic of the cathedral.
And of course, Russian, the style of Russian singing, the technique of producing sounds is different in some Russian choral music.
It is different, but it's something that the Desert Corral has incorporated into its programs for many seasons now. And so in the repertory that we perform, there's always been a special place for Russian music. So, and many of our singers are returning singers. I don't know if your listeners are aware of that we do come together from all over the country, but there's an amazingly good return rate. This is a really exciting opportunity for high-quality singers. Many of these singers have actually direct their own choirs back at home during the regular, you know, September to June part of the year.
So it's a great gig for academics.
Absolutely. We've got a few who are in their doctoral programs that come here in the summer to take part in the Desert Corral. These are all people who are going on. These are not people who have a job for the most of them, who have a job and then come and sing in a chorus at night, you know, go to choral rehearsals a couple of nights. And these are people who have really devoted a career to music, and particularly to choral music.
Well, let's go to some of our American music. We're going to play a track Which is a Revolutionary War song.
Yeah, last year we did a program at the Loretto Chapel called An American Hallelujah, and it was music from some of it from the Revolutionary War period. There were Shaker hymns, spirituals, just a whole variety of 18th and 19th century American music. And this piece that I've selected for this morning is called Chester. It's written by William Billings, who lived from 1746 to 1800 and was really one of the first great American composers. And his music became battle cries, if you will, or theme songs, or the popular songs of the American colonies during the Revolutionary War.
So it's the first track on our disc. Let's hear this song. And that is Chester by William Billings. I think it's important to talk, when we talk about American music, you know, even on the 4th of July, there's so many different kinds of music. It's not all John Philip Sousa.
Yeah, absolutely. And that song that we just heard, by the way, was from the chorale's latest CD, which is called Live from Loretto Chapel. I thought it was interesting, Mary Charlotte, you mentioned before the sound that the chorale will have to create to perform the Rachmaninoff Vespers. I think even there, your listeners might have heard, it's a little bit different kind of sound than we would sing with today. It's a very straight kind of pure tone that was very popular back in that period, particularly in colonial America.
Yeah, it made me think of the Sacred Harp sound.
Exactly, exactly. The sound obviously came from the churches where people did gather to sing, and it also was a reaction to European sound, which, of course, across the culture, people were trying to move away. So that kind of vibrato sound that you hear in opera and would hear in music of that era in Europe was not popular here. It was seemed as almost...
A feat?
Yeah, a feat and ungodly and those things.
Right? Really? And so singing something straightforwardly is more godly than singing it embellished or something?
So it would seem.
Protestantism, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking to Robert Ripps of the Desert Chorale, and their season starts on Friday, July 6th, at the cathedral. What are the acoustics like there?
Well, they're quite amazing. There's a four-second reverberation time in the cathedral. And that, of course, can be a wonderful thing for choral music because it really lets the music resound in the space. But it's also a very tricky thing, and it's one of the things that the singers and our music director, Linda Mack, have to work on. Began yesterday afternoon. They start out rehearsing in rehearsal room, but they have to get into the cathedral pretty quickly to judge the balance. So in other words, when the chorale stops singing a note, it's 4 seconds before in the audience you stop hearing the note.
So it's great for a sustained long tone, mm-hmm. but if you're singing tones that are very, very fast, it might be a little complicated.
Right, and we have a wonderful thing happening this summer because we have, in the past few summers, we've only been 20 singers, but in honor of the 25th anniversary, we've grown the chorale to 24 singers. Now, you might say, why not 25 for 25? But 24 works better in a chorus than 25 because you can split the chorus into two 12-part groups. And Linda Mack has programmed two pieces on the cathedral program that really benefit from that double chorus, as it's called. There's a full-length mass by a 20th century Swiss composer named Frank Martin that is a mass for double choir, and then also a piece by Osvaldo Golijov, who wrote the very popular Einaudamar that was done a couple of seasons ago at the opera.
Right.
And what you get there is you get not only the antiphonal back and forth effects of two choirs singing, but you get the kind of handoff of sound as it goes in and out, and all of that being judged in this acoustic is really an amazing thing to hear. I heartily urge listeners, if you haven't heard this kind of singing in the cathedral, we're very fortunate here in Santa Fe in many ways, but also, if you're not aware of it, we're very fortunate to have wonderful acoustic spaces in many of our historical churches.
Do we have a choral singing tradition in those spaces in Santa Fe going back, decades, centuries?
Yeah. Quite a ways back, we did a program of Hispanic music. Most of it came up the way that much of that culture came here. In other words, from Spain into South America, up through Mexico, and then up. But there definitely is a tradition that followed that route that so much else of culture and trade and politics did follow in the Spanish tradition of the southwestern part of America. So we have dug into that. We're not really focused there this season. There are a few Spanish pieces on the program, and there are also a set of songs that will be dedicated to the memory of Lewis Ballard, who was very involved in the early days of IAIA here in Santa Fe. And
the Institute of American Indian Arts.
Thank you. And he was a composer in his own right, but even perhaps more importantly, a collector, a kind of archivist of Native American songs. He passed away in February, and our music director, Linda Mack, felt that the chorale could and should pay tribute to him. So she has arranged a group of his songs, which will be performed by the women. And that's interesting also because in the tradition, it wasn't normally the women who performed the songs. But, hey, it's 2007 and we're the Desert Chorale, and we're going to do it this way.
Well, there's some women's concerts for women's voices and concerts for men's voices in the season of the Desert Chorale in both, actually it's all in July. There's free noon concerts on July 20th and July 6th at the First Presbyterian Church, and there's also a children's chorus.
Absolutely. We're very proud of our children's chorus. It's a great opportunity to bring music into the lives of kids from our schools. About 18 or 19 schools are represented in our chorus. And they meet and perform and rehearse throughout the school year, of course. But this summer, we are doing a one-week camp, music camp. And we already have over 30 kids signed up. We're very excited about it. We did it last summer, but just did it as a one-day camp, and it was such a success that the parents and kids all wanted us to do it again. So we do it this summer, and there's a real nice payoff to it this year because the kids will work with some, not only our chorus director, Cora Harms, our children's chorus director, Cora Harms, but they'll work with some of the singers from the chorale, particularly Heidi Kim, one of our sopranos, who has two young daughters who she brings here with her during the summer, and they both sing. So Heidi will help prepare them for our 25th anniversary gala concert at the Lenzic on August 5th, and that's a program of operetta and music theater, and some of the kids will be selected and will perform with the chorale on the stage of the Lenzic on August 5th.
Let's go on to another track from our disc. What would you like to play next? We've got so many choices of American music, both contemporary and some of the older stuff as well.
Well, I'd like to play something by one of the composers that we will be featuring this summer in the Cathedral Concert. His name is Eric Whitaker, and he is a young California-based conductor. He's in, composer, and he has written a piece that I love the title to it. Well, it doesn't really have a title. It's the whole song has eight words. It's an E.E. Cummings poem, and the first four words are hope, faith, life, love. So we sort of call that the title, but actually then it goes on to dream, joy, truth, and song. And this composition is solely made up of those eight words, and I'd love to play some of it for you. The chorale will be performing this at the Cathedral this summer.
And it's track 3 on our disc. Let's take a listen. Eric Whitaker is the composer. That's Eric Whitaker. Incredible harmonies in this piece.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's really what the piece is about. And it's just natural for the Desert Chorale singers.
Well, it's unfortunately time for us to go. The Desert Chorale has their season that opens Friday at the Cathedral, right downtown. And there's a whole bunch of different programs going on through the summer. For more information, people can go to desertchorale.org, or they can call 988-2282. And Robert Ripps is the board president. You've been involved in classical and choral music for many years.
Over 35 now. Yeah, started out actually in the opera world, but moved on to other areas of classical music and recordings and publications. And life brought me here to Santa Fe, as it has a way to do for
for those of us who are magnetized.
And I've enjoyed every minute of being involved in the chorale. It's a great organization.
Well, thank you.
Proud to be part of it.
Thank you so much, and happy 4th of July. We've listened to a couple of tracks of American music. And there's much more. So, Robert Ripps, thanks again.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now, and we will hear from Ron Bloomberg and some spots from our beloved underwriters. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just the voice in the crowd. You know the great saying of Henry David Thoreau that most men live lives of quiet desperation? I'm one of those men. I kind of know it before, but now I know for certain. My life will never be heroic or memorable. My life is a series of aggravation, frustration, infuriation. Okay, let me get right to it. I lost my wallet. When the realization set in that it was really missing this time, that it wasn't in the usual places, it was gone, and so was I. The thought of making all those calls to replace all those credit cards, my driver's license, my ATM card, my CVS card, voter identification card, Southwest Rapid Rewards card, my gelato card, where I was two hole punches away from two scoops free. The only saving grace was my Albertsons card, which was in the wallet, but who cares? You don't need that one anymore. I know what you're thinking. Maybe some good Samaritan will find my wallet and call me and return it. Well, there are no good Samaritans left. There are only Samaritans left. The good ones wised up and are making a bundle, working in hedge funds. The worst is there were items in my wallet that are irreplaceable. No value can be put on the little photos I've carried around for years. An adorable one of me at age 6, at 12 when I was in summer camp. A shot of me at 30 pretending to have fun. And my favorite, a close-up of me sitting on a bench in the plaza having a chicken fajita with a green pepper dripping out of my mouth. Okay, it's a long shot, but if you happen to find my wallet, you can keep the three single-dollar bills and my Captain Marvel secret decoding ring. No questions asked. Talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
I'd like to welcome now, joining us by telephone, Bill Burke White. He's our foreign correspondent on KSFR, and he's a professor of international relations at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be with you again.
Always good to have you. Let's start with news that probably a lot of people have already heard. Lewis Scooter Libby was not exactly pardoned, but basically the moral equivalent thereof. His sentence was commuted by President George W. Bush. Any comments from you?
Well, I think it's just appalling, as I assume most of your listeners do, that the president would decide that he's effectively above the law in saying that Scooter Libby should not serve any jail time after having been convicted. Of course, yesterday the U.S. courts said that Libby would have to sit in jail during his appeal. And President Bush's response was to say, well, I don't want you to have to sit in jail and to use his presidential power to commute the sentence. I think there's a $50,000 fine, which may sound like a lot, but for Scooter Libby, I don't think that that is a very serious punishment, and no jail time. So I think it's truly appalling for the president to use power that he does constitutionally have, but this is not where the president's supposed to use it. When someone breaks a law at his, essentially in the service of the president, that person ought to serve jail time. I think it's a sad sight for American justice that the president was willing to do that. I didn't actually think the president had thought he could get away with doing that, and I hope there are political consequences for him for it. But it's a very sad statement about justice in this country when the president does that.
The topic of our conversation today is peace and justice. You were recently in Nuremberg, Germany, at a conference where you actually sat in the room where the Nuremberg trials happened after World War II. What was that about?
Last week I was in Nuremberg, and it was actually an extraordinarily moving moment when one sits down in the courtroom in the Nuremberg Higher Regional Court, where the Nuremberg trials took place after World War II, and when one is welcomed by the German foreign minister, who apologized in his welcoming speech at least four or five times. And one thing that I thought was very interesting was that the Germans are willing to say they're sorry, and that doesn't mean that what happened in Germany wasn't absolutely horrific. It was. But many other countries, including the United States, have done horrific things along the way for which we never apologize. So we sat there, and the German foreign minister apologized for the atrocities that were committed. And we spent 3 days in a very deep discussion hosted by the German and Finnish governments thinking about what you do after massive atrocities, be they a civil war, an ethnic conflict, or a Holocaust, in terms of providing justice. And there has been, in recent years, much discussion about what is appropriate in that context and whether there is, in a sense, a choice between peace and justice, whether after a conflict you can bring about a peaceful settlement and still provide justice, or whether you ought to pursue peace and not worry about justice, or in contrast, if you ought to pursue justice and say justice is so important that even if it might threaten a peace process, you ought to make sure that the perpetrators of mass crimes are, you know, face justice in whatever form. So we had three really interesting days with some very, you know, both high-level government officials speaking as well as individuals from the countries that are most affected by these questions. So a fascinating meeting, to say the least.
The first question that comes to my mind is, what is justice? That's not something that is even the same cross-culturally or in a political conversation over the table at a cafe. I mean, how is justice defined? Does it mean prosecution?
It's a very hard question, and it's an important one, because most people, when they think of justice in this country, think of probably first, you know, a courtroom with a judge sitting there, and then they often will think about punishment as the most important aspect of justice. Punishment often being time served in jail, as we were just talking about with Scooter Libby, or in the extreme cases, punishment perhaps even being a death penalty. And what's interesting, if you go around the world and talk to people, they have very, very different understandings of justice. Let me give you a couple of examples, because I think that may be a better illustration than me just trying to describe some of them. Last year, I spent a good deal of time in northern Uganda. And northern Uganda has an ethnic community, or tribal community, known as the Acholi peoples. And the Acholi peoples are known for kind of a culture of internal forgiveness and healing. And for them, when you ask them what justice means, they talk about being given rights. In other words, they say, for me, justice would be me having a voice in government, or me having a right of freedom of speech, or a right of freedom of assembly, to use sort of the Americanized terms thereof. They don't think about punishment per se, but think about, you know, justice as securing rights that will protect them from future harms. You might go even to some parts of Iraq or the Middle East, and justice is essentially, tribal within your community or your clan. It might be an elder within that community reconciling between the clans based on whatever violation might have occurred. If you go to some parts of Rwanda, justice is again a very communal idea, and there they've harkened back to sort of older ideas about performing service, right? So if you kill someone, or perhaps something less than that, if you steal someone's goat, let's say, your punishment might be that you have to spend a week milking the goats of the person whose goat you stole, in trying to bring them back to the situation they were in beforehand. And so we live in a country and a culture where justice is essentially an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and, you know, a life for a life, in a sense. And in many other parts of the world, that is not the case. And one of the really hard parts about thinking about peace and justice is deciding whose justice we ought to be talking about. The United Nations go into a country like Rwanda or Bosnia and impose a Western conception of justice, and there are some good reasons for that, perhaps, or should one look to, you know, communal visions of justice, even if sometimes under those local versions of justice, The punishment doesn't seem fitting for the crime from our perspective, and I think that's something we all need to be grappling with when we think about what role the international community ought to play in these kinds of countries.
I think what you bring up makes one think of the purpose of justice with a question of whether it's about punishment, the question of whether it's about rehabilitation, and the psychological element of people who've been harmed or whose families have been harmed, bringing somebody else to quote-unquote justice, whether it be having their goats milked by this person. When, for example, in Rwanda, Rwanda's a country who's seen horrors that most of us can't even begin to imagine or contemplate, when that communal type of justice about which you're speaking is handed out, what kind of changes happen? Does it work psychologically?
Well, let me take just a little step back and say when we think about justice, there's usually four different justifications that can be given for why we would want, you know, justice or what purpose it should serve. The first is incapacitation, right? That's the idea that if there is a nasty criminal walking down the street shooting people, if you put him in jail or kill him or whatever, he won't do it again. And a second vision of justice is retributive justice, right? That's the idea that I was harmed, and so now I want to harm you back as a way of sort of evening the score. And if you, you know, go back to sort of 300 years ago or 200 years ago, right, this was almost the notion of the duel, right? You do something bad to me, I get a right to shoot a bullet at you, and if I hit and you die, I'm not guilty of murder. It was retribution, and if I miss, you're lucky. But retribution is really how we often think about justice here in the United States. A third vision of justice would be rehabilitative, right? That's the idea, and this is often the way we think about with maybe minors who commit crimes. Someone commits a crime, we're going to try to make them a better person so they don't do it again. In the United States, we're very, very bad at rehabilitative justice, right? We throw someone in jail, and usually they come out a hardened criminal rather than a reformed person. But certainly in our early colonial era, you know, religion was a big part of that, and the idea was to make someone a better person. The final conception of justice, which is one we don't think about very much at all here, and I think is what you're talking about with your question now about Rwanda, is restorative justice. And the idea there is that through the justice process, can you make the community whole again? And restorative justice, I think, makes much more sense as a way of thinking when you're dealing with very widespread or massive crimes. It probably doesn't make sense when you're talking about, you know, someone stole your car, the community may not be harmed by it, but a country like Rwanda, the community may be devastated by 800,000 people being killed essentially by their neighbors. And in that context, thinking about how you rebuild reorganize the community so it's healthy and vibrant again and doesn't breed this kind of crime may be the most important goal. And what the Rwandans have done is they've created a system called the Gacaca, which actually refers to kind of an open piece of grass where the community comes together and sits down, and people can stand up and essentially testify against others in the community, and local elders then decide if a crime was committed. And the punishments can range from usually relatively low-level kind of sanctions, like you have to milk their goats or build their house, to longer term things like you have to spend 6 months or a year planting grain for the family that you harmed. Now, sometimes this is helpful. It may be very helpful that there's a new house built or maybe a new community center built. At the same time, when you end up with a young man who may have committed a crime in this community, having to come back and spend a year within the community performing community service, in a sense, that can end up being slightly counterproductive because you have someone who is seen as the perpetrator of mass crimes within the community, and oftentimes that person becomes oppressed themselves. It reminds me of some of the early punishments in England or even the United States, right, where someone who committed a crime might be put in a sort of special kind of shackles in the community square and be forced to undergo somewhat humiliating treatment, and people come by and throw things at them or whatnot. And sometimes you see that in a country where punishment ends up being a form of service, but in a community that wasn't necessarily your own, and the perpetrator essentially becomes victim. So it's not an easy set of choices, and when you start thinking about how do you restore a community through justice, it may be very hard to accomplish in fact, though a very good idea if one can make it work.
We're talking to Bill Burke White. There are some cases where this tension between peace and justice that you talked about earlier is illustrated when the question arises after atrocities are committed. Should the people who committed them be given amnesty in order for a peace process to continue or to take place in the first place, or whether people committing these crimes should be prosecuted? What are some examples of that happening either today or in recent history?
Yeah, so think about it in this sense, right? If someone has committed massive crimes and they're sitting in government, or maybe they're the head of a rebel group with an army out in the jungle, and you want to end the conflict or to have a regime change, often the person who committed the crimes doesn't want to leave power if they're about to go face prosecution or perhaps something worse. And so they ask for an amnesty in exchange for either leaving power or coming in from the jungle. And that amnesty would essentially guarantee them freedom from being prosecuted. And there's a long history of this sort of amnesty. It's the way most early wars ended. Either you killed the person you didn't you were going to war against, or you gave them an amnesty in exchange for surrender. Some recent examples on a kind of spectrum. Let's start in Latin America for a minute and think about Chile. When Pinochet left power, he granted himself an amnesty. He ran the government. He passed an amnesty, immunizing himself from ever being prosecuted for the crimes he committed. And then he did leave power, and there was a remarkable democratic transition in Chile, and it's now a vibrant, free, and human rights respecting country. And so that, some might say, was an example of a successful amnesty in exchange for a regime change. Of course, that meant that for 15 years, Pinochet lived in a very nice villa, free of any justice, and the victims of his crimes were free of justice. Now, that did change when he went to the United Kingdom for back surgery in 1998 and was arrested and faced prosecution in Europe for crimes he committed in Chile. But there's an example of peace essentially being prioritized over justice. Another example that sort of has a different outcome would be South Africa. South Africa is a country where you had a nasty apartheid regime, and the apartheid regime said, we will leave power if we are given an amnesty. And in South Africa, the process was much, much better. Rather than simply the government passing an amnesty for itself, an agreement was reached between the outgoing power and the new incoming African National Congress power for an amnesty process where individuals would have to go and testify as to what they did if they wanted to be given amnesty, right? You couldn't just go.
They had to confess their crimes.
They would have to confess to the specific acts they committed. And what that did is it created an extraordinary historical record. And you can go now to Johannesburg and go through the testimony. Actually, much of it you can even find online. And people, victims, can see what was done to them and see it admitted. But if those people admitted it, they could never be prosecuted for it.
And the people who didn't confess, what happened to them?
Well, the law says that if you didn't confess within the appropriate period of time, you would be prosecuted. And that was kind of the threat, the stick, if you will, to convince people to go, give often very moving and very powerful testimony. But what's happened in South Africa is that more than 10 years later, there has not been a single prosecution. So while there was this threat of prosecution, it's never materialized. And you now have some victims groups and victims in South Africa saying, wait a minute, the people who did things to us didn't confess. They were supposed to be prosecuted, but the government has failed to do so. Let me give you a third example, because it's one that we're in the midst of at the moment, and I think frames the debate in a really interesting way, which is northern Uganda. In Uganda, there is a group that I think we talked about maybe on the radio a year or so ago called the Lord's Resistance Army. About 20 years ago, began a civil war against the government of President Museveni, and they're now in a peace negotiation. However, the heads of the Lord's Resistance Army have been indicted criminally by the International Criminal Court in The Hague in the Netherlands. And if the International Criminal Court can catch these guys, they will be prosecuted. They have now said that they will only agree to a peace deal and come in from the jungle if the International Criminal Court drops the charges against them. Yet the International Criminal Court is a court created to provide criminal accountability. It's a court Uganda voluntarily agreed to. And so there's this real question now whether we prioritize peace and essentially drop the prosecution against the two warlords, the heads of the organization, or if one keeps the pressure on them, keeps the indictments in place, and says, if you want to agree to a peace deal, fine, but you may well face justice when you do. And I think that's probably the hardest case we face today in deciding what to do in terms of peace and justice.
And the International Criminal Court has a real choice to make there, but what about the people of Uganda? Is there a sense of what they want and how they feel about it?
It's very mixed in a sense. You have many groups in northern Uganda who, when a survey was done of them about a year ago, and it's hard to survey in refugee camps in northern Uganda, obviously, but the data was very clear that most people prioritize peace. For 20 years, they have been living in refugee camps, and they want their lives back. And so most of them, I think, would say, give us peace first. And though there are other groups, in particular victims, who will say, no, we want justice as well, but I think the vast majority of the people of northern Uganda want peace. And that might make sound like, all right, then it's an easy choice. If the people want peace, give them peace and withdraw the indictments. The question's a little bit trickier than that, because first of all, we don't know if one withdraws the indictments. Will these rebels really come in from the jungle? For 20 years, they've been engaged in off-and-on negotiations when there weren't indictments in place, and they never came in from the jungle. So you'd essentially have to be trusting the word of these warlords. And the other question is it possible to get both, right? Could one bring these guys in from the jungle and have both peace and justice? And the saddest part of this story, I think, is that the answer to that question is both peace and justice possible is absolutely yes. If we could simply apprehend the two warlords who run this rebel movement in northern Uganda, if we could put handcuffs on them, the conflict would end because of the nature of that organization, and you could prosecute them. The saddest part is that there is no country in the world, not the United States, not the European powers, not anyone in Africa, who's willing to send troops into the jungle and arrest these guys. And the International Criminal Court was created without the power to arrest anyone. They don't have troops, right? So they can't send in a black helicopter and arrest someone. If they could, you could overcome the whole peace versus justice debate in northern Uganda. But the only way to get these guys is for them to voluntarily come in out of the jungle, at which point you might well have to trade peace and justice, at least in the short term, and see what can be done later on.
Bill, we've only got about a minute or two left, but I wanted to ask you a question that was based on something you said before about Pinochet going to England for back surgery and being arrested there. What is the story in various European countries about being able to arrest and prosecute people for crimes committed elsewhere?
Yeah, briefly, a number of European countries have laws that allow them to prosecute people who commit crimes in other countries, and that's what happened with Pinochet. The Spanish indicted him for crimes committed in Chile. And in fact, in many European countries, the victims of the crime can force the national government to bring a criminal prosecution. We can't do that in the United States, and that's how many of these cases start in Europe. And recently, in fact, the Belgians had a law that would allow this to happen. And they, among other people, indicted Ariel Sharon from Israel. And the United States got very upset at this. And we said to the Belgians, revoke this law so that you can't prosecute these people, or we will move NATO headquarters from Brussels to Warsaw. This was back when we were talking about the New Europe thing. And the Belgians did withdraw the law. The Germans did not, and interestingly enough, there is currently a case in Germany against Donald Rumsfeld for war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if I were Donald Rumsfeld's lawyer, I would tell him not to fly to Germany anytime soon, because he too might be arrested.
And
perhaps
in fact,
the Germans
canceled.
Want to prosecute Scoot Libby next, since we don't seem to be willing to do so.
I mean, Donald Rumsfeld canceled a trip to Germany, didn't he?
He did. He was supposed to go about a year ago and canceled the trip for this very reason.
Bill Burke-White, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. It's always a great pleasure and education.
The pleasure was mine, and have a good morning.
You too.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bill Burke-White, our foreign correspondent, is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Barry Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me by email at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. By the way, we're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. So if you go to santafe.radiocafe.org, you just click, or you can go to the archive of past shows. Stay tuned now for the Jazz Hoedown. Tomorrow is the 4th of July. We will be broadcasting live from the Plaza, this and other shows on KSFR. So keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR 90.7 FM on the web at ksfr.org. Adios. Hasta luego. Bye.